four girls, and they're unfortunately not here with me this evening, but they are going to their own Bible school there at Lichtenstein's, which is where they are attending when they can. My wife did kind of short-term fill-in with teaching this year at Shalom, and so her evenings are pretty busy, too, with getting ready for the next day at school, so she's not going along on too many of these speaking engagements. But this evening, the title of the message was shortened a little bit from what I was given. So when I was assigned this topic, I was told that it was lovers of pleasure, dangers in the last days, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. And so the topic that I think was listed in the general bulletin was more of a dangers in the last days, a little bit more open-ended. What I studied for is a little more focused on the idea of lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. And so if you wonder why I'm focusing on that, that's the reason, and that's what we're going to talk about this evening from that text taken from 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 6. 1 through 7, actually. As I was thinking about this topic, one of the things that came to my mind was a story in Pilgrim's Progress and thinking about our culture and our culture being a culture that loves pleasure, and I don't think any of us would disagree with that probably, and most of you could probably very well agree with that as you look around and see how our culture lives and what they live for. But I thought about Vanity Fair in Pilgrim's Progress, where they were walking through on their journey there, pilgrim and faithful, or Christian and faithful, and I just thought I'd read that as we think about our own situation walking through life. John Bunyan said, "Then I saw in my dream that when they got out of the wilderness, they presently saw a town before them. The name of that town was Vanity Fair, and a fair was held there all year round. The road to the celestial city was through the midst of the town and the great fair, and so the two pilgrims must needs go that way. As they walked, they saw the places, rows, and streets where all sorts of things were bought and sold. One street was called the English Row, another the French Row, another the Italian Row, another the German Row. And as the pilgrims went quietly along intent upon their own duty, they were beset by a number of hawkers and barkers urging them to buy of their goods. 'What will you buy? What will you buy?' they cried, and they offered all sorts of vanities and follies. The people who visited this fair and who spent most of their time there were dressed in rich and gaudy apparel, and they seemed to have nothing to do but to eat, drink, and be merry. Now, as I said, the way to the celestial city lies only through this town where the fair is kept. Anyone who wishes to reach the city must travel through this town, for to avoid it would mean departing from the world entirely." I thought that's a pretty good picture of us and our journey through life and through the situations we often face, being beset by, what did it say there, the barkers and the hawkers, the people that were trying to sell something. And there are so many different things that can distract us in the area of lovers of pleasure. Let's turn to 2 Timothy 3 and read the verses there in 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 7. And that will be the text this evening as we think about this subject of lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, the dangers in the last days. "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, tradey, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. From such turn away. For of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women, laden with sins, led away with divers lusts, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth." Kind of a dark picture we get there as we read these verses, and it talks about these last days that are coming and the perilous or troublesome times that will go with them. So a little bit like Christian and faithful, as they were going on their journey to the celestial city, each of us is on a journey as well. We're on a journey through life. And sometimes when we're traveling somewhere, somebody will ask, is the trip for business or for pleasure? And often we can either assign it to one or the other. And I think the general thinking is that, you know, it's either related to work or to leisure. And as we travel along the journey of life, I think that should be a question that we are asking ourselves, is maybe not if it, whether it's for business or pleasure, but what is my purpose as I go through life? What is the meaning of why I'm doing what I'm doing, and what am I focusing on? Because there are certainly many things that will draw our attention away if we don't keep our eyes focused on our purpose as Christians. And just like Christian and faithful that are traveling through the Vanity Fair, there's all these voices and things and options that we have, and they can definitely lead us away and make us become lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. There's a couple of questions that came to my mind as I looked at these verses, and first of all is, when is this happening? And maybe secondly, who is Paul talking about in these verses? Who is this written to, this text here in 2 Timothy 3? So when Paul says that in the last days, perilous times will come, when is this happening? When are the last days? And I think that's one of the questions we have to answer, because I think that if we don't answer that question, understand it, we can kind of put ourselves in the wrong place and say, well, this doesn't apply to me because it's related to some other time or some other group of people, and kind of exempt ourselves from the impact of these verses. So when it says there, in the last days perilous times shall come, was Paul simply informing Timothy here that sometime in the future, far off in the future, there would be these people that would become increasingly evil and love pleasure more than lovers than loving God? And I think that we can probably look at our New Testament here, and we know that when we look at this, we could ask ourselves the question, well, did the people in Paul's time have any of these characteristics? Did they struggle with any of the evil characteristics that are listed here in these verses? And I think that if you know anything about New Testament history and the situations that Paul and Timothy and the others there faced, we know that they had, I think, all of these types of characteristics were present as Paul was writing this to Timothy. It wasn't some new thing. It was a reality at that time. And Paul was providing Timothy here. This is one of the pastoral epistles, and it was given to Timothy as instruction on how to lead a church. There was a flock that he was supposed to be taking leadership in, and Paul was helping him and coaching him on how to do this. And so this was not, even though it says that they're in the last days, which we often think of as sometime in the distant future, Paul was writing this to Timothy for a situation he was facing right now, and he was saying, in the last days. So something else is going on here a little bit. I think this does have a future aspect as well. But there's also the sense here that what Paul is talking about is a present, maybe the last age. He's talking about the time that they're living in between the coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ here. So we might say more like it's an age or a period of time. And so that's what I think, this is where Paul is talking about here and talking to Timothy about this situation. In Hebrews 1:2, it actually uses in these last days, using it in the present tense. And so it's not too much of a stretch to say that this is talking about, it was talking in the present tense to Timothy here. It's also talking to us in the present tense, and it's also talking to people in the future in the present tense as well. And so it's applicable whether we're in 50 AD or 2026, or if God doesn't come back or Jesus doesn't come back before 2226, it will still be applicable in that time as well. And so Paul is sort of, I think we could say he's describing a present, ongoing, and future reality for the church, not only a future catastrophe that will happen just at one time in the future, but something that's happening all through these last days. However, when you look at the world, or especially looking at our culture here in the United States, you do have to ask the question, does it seem that the dangers of the perilous times are becoming more common as time goes on? And I think that when you look around at our culture, we would probably, most of us, agree that it does seem like it's becoming more and more prevalent, that people are becoming lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. And I think that also applies to the church as well. Is it more than 150 years ago? Is one of the questions we might say, like, you know, we could look back 1,000 years, but we don't even really have an idea what was happening 1,000 years ago too much. But even 150 years ago, when we have a much better idea what was happening, have we become more lovers of pleasure now than we were 150 years ago? Now, I don't recommend using AI to make your sermons, but it does have its value. And I put in a prompt into ChatGPT or one of the engines and said, does society pursue pleasure now more than 150 years ago? And I thought, well, see what it says. And it said, yes, modern society pursues pleasure far more openly, systematically, and on a massive scale than society did 150 years ago, which would have been around the 1870s. 150 years ago, during the Victorian period, dominant cultural norms, especially among the middle and upper classes, emphasized restraint, duty, self-control, hard work, and moral virtue over immediate or sensory pleasure. And then it said, public discourse often framed pleasure-seeking, especially sensual or hedonistic pursuits, as dangerous, sinful, or a threat to societal order influenced by evangelical Christianity. And so when I read that, I was like, well, I think that's a pretty good summary probably of how times have changed. And that's not saying that 150 years ago that this was, you know, everybody was a Christian and everything was all great. There was lots of problems 150 years ago that were much worse then than they are now. But it said that the cultural norms were restraint, duty, self-control, hard work, and moral virtue. And I think when you look around at our society, it's hard to say those are the dominant cultural norms of our society today. I don't think there's any doubt that there's a much greater tolerance and open pursuit of pleasure seeking today than there was 200 years ago. But I think it's an ongoing reality. Maybe it is increasing, but it's something that we definitely are faced with. And I think we can also observe this in our Mennonite communities as well, where there seems to be more and more emphasis on pleasure seeking and sports and more luxurious vacations and things, and just there's a sense that our living standards keep rising. And I have that same struggle with myself. Many of us have good jobs. We have plenty of means and things like that. And it's very hard to live in a culture like that and not have this pleasure seeking creep into our lives. I think that probably all of us are faced with that to some level or another. And pleasure seeking is often seen as a sign of decline, whether it's in a nation or in a church or in an individual level. When pleasure is pursued because there's basically been enough resources that have been accumulated to enable and justify it, that's often when it becomes something that almost becomes a rot in a society. You see that in the example of the rich fool when he, after he had accumulated a whole bunch of goods, he said, now I'm going to build bigger barns and I'm going to sit back and eat, drink, and be merry. And I think that when you see that happening in a society or to a person in the church, you start to see a society that is in decline. Whether that was looking at history, the late Roman Empire with their bread and circuses, or even today, the late maybe American Empire drowning in debt and all kinds of evil, you start to see that it's a symptom of something that's very bad. So we need to be very aware that we are living in the perilous times that Paul is describing here. It's not for some future generation only, but it's also very much directed at us and where we're living right now in our time. It's very easy to be lured into complacency and comfort by all the things and the means that we have available. Jesus said in Matthew 24:12, and he said, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. And I think that's a very real warning for us in our times. There's no doubt that we are living in these last days, in these perilous times, and that warning, I think, is directly for us. If you look back in chapter 2 here in 2 Timothy, in verse 3, it says, you therefore must endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who has enlisted him as a soldier. And then he also goes on to use the example of athletes as well who train. And what is the goal of the soldier or the athlete? Well, the goal is ultimately victory. That's what they're training for, because they want to win either a race or a war or something. And so that's what they put their training into and why they do what they do. They're actively participating instead of observing from their recliner. Which, in other words, they're doing the hard work. They're not living in luxury and comfort. there in the barracks or on the battlefield, and often the people, then especially in the sport, in the example of sports, there's also the people on the field who have trained and are playing the game, and then there's the millions of people who are sitting back and watching and observing what's happening. And what does it take to win? Well, those verses say that it's enduring hardness. It doesn't talk about living in luxury or being lovers of pleasure that's going to help us to win this, but it's enduring hardness. And I just, as I think about that, living these perilous times and becoming lovers of pleasure, I think that's just a challenge that I have to think about for myself and just maybe for each of us as well. Are we spending time on our recliners observing the race, or are we training and running the race? And I think that's one of the things that we need to keep, again, in our focus as we think about our purpose going through the journey of life. What is my goal and what is my purpose? It says also that he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved, in verse 13 there. And I wonder sometimes where we as Mennonites are in relation to being observers or participants. Are we enduring hardness or are we enjoying comfort? And I think that that's something, again, I'm not trying to be critical or say that about other people, because it's something that I'm faced with myself as well. Where am I at in that regard? Another question we might ask here is, who was this being written to? Who was the group of people that Paul was writing this at the time? Was it only the pagans living around Timothy? Was he singling them out and saying these bad pagan people here, they're going to be really bad? The list of attributes here shows that people who are very self-centered and morally corrupt, people who are lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. And they certainly don't sound like Christians in any way. All these things are the very opposite of what a Christian should be, of the characteristics and attributes of a Christian. But how much value is it to make the point that sinful people are very sinful, to just say, well, these people are all out there and they're really bad? Well, that's true. Maybe that tells us the dangers that we're up against. But it seems like Paul here was warning Timothy about something else, even more dangerous maybe, and that you see that in the last description that's given there in verse 5, where it says, having a form of godliness. And so it lists all these attributes, these very bad attributes, and then it ends by saying they had a form of godliness. And so it doesn't really sound like he's talking about people, pagan people out there who are, living a life of immorality and sin. But he's also, and maybe some of these things obviously are that, but he's also talking about people who have a form of godliness, who seem like maybe they made a profession, maybe they're people that are actually inside the church as well. They had a form of godliness, but underneath, they loved themselves more than they loved God. And I had to think about the parable of the sower in Luke 8 there, where Jesus said, now the ones that fell among the thorns are those who, when they have heard, go out and are choked with the cares, riches, and pleasures of life and bring no fruit to maturity. I think that's a little bit the idea here, where we see this having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. They started out on the right track, but something happened. They were choked with the cares, riches, and pleasures of life and brought no fruit to maturity. So can these people still be in the church? I think it is possible, and unfortunately, I'm afraid it's the reality that many of the people that are described in these verses are actually not just evil people out there, but they're also people that are even in the church and claim to be Christians. Then the question might be, well, how does this happen? How does somebody claim to be a Christian and then fall into this same definition where they become a lover of pleasure more than a lover of God? Well, maybe first of all, we should answer the question, what is pleasure, just to define what we're talking about when we say what is pleasure. The definition is the gratification of the senses or of the mind, agreeable sensations or emotions, and opposed to pain or sorrow, the opposite of that. It can also be happiness produced by the expectation or the enjoyment of something good, delightful, or satisfying. And so again, it's not necessarily a negative word. It has some very good parts, but when it's talked about in a hedonistic type of way, then it becomes a sinful thing as well. The Greek of these two words, lovers of pleasure and lovers of God, are actually referring to two different types of people. And I thought that was kind of interesting, studying into this a little bit. The lover of pleasure was the Greek word philodonos, which I may not be saying that right, but that's what I think it how it's pronounced. And that term refers to a pleasure-loving or hedonistic person who is given over to the pursuit of earthly pleasures. And so it's talking more about this type of a person more than just talking about pleasure in itself. Hedonism is that the ethical theory that pleasure in the sense of the satisfaction of desires is the highest good and the proper aim of human life. And anybody that believes that obviously doesn't really believe that there's much to live for if we believe that that's the only thing that you can get from life is just do what feels good, basically. Then you have the lover of God, and that one is philotheos, and that refers to individuals who have a deep affection for the Lord, pursue him, and strive to obey him daily. And so it's talking about a righteous or a holy person, a lover of God, in contrast to this lover of pleasure, this person that basically loves one either pleasure or loves God. Question we might ask, does Christianity have a problem with pleasure? Is that something that, you know, when we hear the word pleasure, is it automatically put into the sin bin? You know, is that always bad? Who is the creator of pleasure? Is another thing we could ask. Is it God or is it Satan? Well, I think that's what we'd like to look at for the rest of this sermon is I'd like to consider the how of pleasure. How can we make sure that we keep pleasure in its proper place in our lives as we live as Christians so that it does have a place in our life, but it doesn't take over and become our love instead of our love being placed in God as it should be. If you look throughout the Bible, and there would be many different instances we could bring up here, but Psalm 16:11 says, "Thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore." And so there the idea of pleasure is used directly in the service of God. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. But then we have Titus 3:3 in our verses here. "For we ourselves were also sometimes foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving divers lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy, hateful and hating one another." And so there we have pleasure used in a very negative way, as well as here where it talks about lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. And so pleasure is used both good and bad in the Bible. It has a good aspect and also has a bad aspect. So the question is, what should it be doing? What place does it take in our lives as Christians? Well, if you go back to the beginning of the Bible, to Genesis 3, you see that the temptation there where Eve saw the fruit, she was tempted by it, she took it and shared it with Adam, and they both decided to just do it, do what seemed good, and take it. But then we know what happened immediately. There was the shame, there was the hiding, there was the guilt and the separation from God that immediately followed grabbing that pleasure that they thought looked so appealing, but immediately had very negative consequences for them and for all of us through today. And it's kind of the same pattern we've been repeating ever since, is we think that we can somehow pursue good gifts apart from the giver, from God, who is really the one that gives us those gifts and brings the meaning and the pleasure behind things. We can think about Solomon. You know, he tried everything. Wealth and women, work, wine, all those things. And in the end, he said it's all just vanity. Meaningless, striving after the wind, it doesn't satisfy at all. And even though he kind of becomes a little more hopeful in the end of Ecclesiastes, he doesn't really paint a very good picture of following after pleasure. In the end, it's just vanity and vanity. And I think we can all relate, actually I'm sure we can all relate, to chasing wrong or questionable pleasures and finding that in the end it just didn't fulfill us. Whatever it was, a new experience, some new toy we got, or a feeling, a substance, all it ended up with us feeling, you know, we felt guilty, addicted, or just flat, like the buyer's remorse, like I wish I just hadn't spent the money doing that or buying that thing after I actually got it. And we know the whole world around us is saying, you know, buy this and buy that, and this will bring happiness and that will bring happiness, and people live for the weekend and, you know, for what they can do that feels good. But they all know it doesn't fulfill too, and I think that people just think that maybe the next thing is what's going to actually fulfill me, but it never does. And that's the one side of pleasure, that thing where it just becomes something that consumes us and becomes our love and our pursuit, but doesn't fill us. There's also the sense, too, where there's the opposite side of that, where pleasure itself, Christians can become like this and say that, well, then if it's bad in that regard, then it must all be bad. And so I shouldn't smile and I shouldn't have any fun and I should wear dark clothes and have a stern countenance and, you know, make sure that people know that I'm a very serious Christian and I don't have fun or involved in that kind of thing. Well, that's not right either. We know that the Christian life is supposed to be a life of joy, not of drudgery and being as, you know, as stern as possible. So where does pleasure fit into the Christian life? What was God's intent as he gave us, you know, the ability to experience pleasure, but to experience it, I think, as also being a lover of God in the way that we experience it? Well, if you go back from Genesis 3, go back to the Garden of Eden a couple chapters back in 1 and 2, before that sin, before the fall, you see what God created for people. He created this garden that was filled with pleasures for all the senses, I think. You know, it was a perfect place to live, and even work was something that was pleasurable in the garden. There was work in the garden, but it was something that was not a drudgery. It was not by the sweat of their brow. It was something that I think was a form of pleasure, just like any of the other pleasures with sights and tastes and touches and things like that. And all of it, God said, it was very good. He declared himself that this was his intent for humans to live in this place and that his creation was very good. And unfortunately, then Genesis 3 comes not long after that and things go downhill. And now pleasure is taken out of context and it begins to be used in destructive ways instead of the ways that God meant it to be. So pleasure itself isn't the problem. It is a gift, and it's meant to be used. It's meant to be for Christians when used in the right places and with the right boundaries. Psalm 16:11 there again, it says about at your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. In your presence there is fullness of joy. And so it's very much anchored in the idea that we can only enjoy true pleasure when it's in the fullness of joy and in the presence of God. 1 Timothy 6:17, God richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Again, another that idea coming through there. The ultimate source of pleasure isn't out there in creation. I think that's something that people often get wrong too. It's really found in the Creator. But people think, well, if I go out, I can find pleasure outside of that. But we know that never happens. And Jesus didn't come to take away joy. He said in John 10:10 that I came that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. And that was his goal for us as Christians. And I think that that's where, when we allow Jesus to take our life, when our love for him is what is the general, which is our primary focus, then he reshapes those desires and redeems them, whatever they are, those same things that make somebody a lover of pleasure more than a lover of God and take them away from God. Some of those same pleasures in the right context are okay, but when they're outside of that, they become very destructive as well. Whether it's food or sex or work or entertainment, all of them should be done for the glory of God, and they all have their place for Christians when they point back to God. Maybe it's just some more thoughts on this idea of pleasure, some characteristics that I thought of that make it different than worldly pleasure. And one of them is that godly pleasure does not leave a bad aftertaste. Now, we all know about aftertaste. Food is one of the pleasures that God has given us to enjoy. But some food does not leave a very pleasurable taste in our mouth, whether it's diet soda. Some people do not like the taste of artificial sweetener that it leaves in your mouth, which is fine. I don't mind it, but some people don't like it. Another one is the taste of cilantro, the herb that is used in tacos and things like that, which, again, I don't think you can hardly have a taco without it. But for some people, they taste the taste of cilantro as soap, or there was a family from our church that tasted it for the first time. Somebody served it in a meal they were at, and they all tasted, they said it tasted like a stink bug smells. And they were trying to eat this, and they all tasted the very same thing. Which, again, if another family had sat there, they would have probably thought it tasted great. But for some reason, something in our brains, there's about 30% of the people that taste cilantro, and it just leaves a really bad taste in their mouth. But godly pleasure does not leave a bad aftertaste, whether it's hangovers, addictions, diseases, more stress because of the things that we thought would bring us less stress, whatever it is. Godly pleasure is something that you can look back on with joy instead of regret. When you look back on experiencing pleasure in the way that God meant, whether in, you know, in family life, in marriage life, in all those different ways, they bring back joy instead of regret. I read about one pastor who talked about how much he enjoyed the pleasure, the simple pleasure of moving into the house. He lived in Arizona, I think, but still got kind of cold in the winter there in the desert. And he moved into this house where there was a heated floor in the bathroom. And again, that's one of the simple pleasures, is a warm floor in when the weather is cold. But he thought it was a little strange that it was only on the one side of the two-person sink. It was on his side, fortunately, which he said gave him a little bit of pleasure, too, that wasn't on his wife's, but he said that was probably the wrong kind of pleasure. But again, he thought it was a little strange, but he didn't really want to overthink it because it was pretty nice on these cold mornings. And so he went on for a while and a couple months, and then one morning he stepped out into the hallway and found it was soaked with water, and he followed the trail back to the bathroom and discovered the source of his warmed floor was there was a hot water leak underneath the foundation or the piping, and it was coming up now through the floor and had flooded through the house. And he had to rip up all the tiles and go down to the concrete underneath and jackhammer that out. And he said thousands of dollars later in repair bills, he realized that, again, that the short-term pleasure of that warm floor was in no way equal to the pain that it brought later. And I think that's just a very, very natural example or human example of how pleasure works. And also the thing is, sometimes when we experience something, we don't want to think too hard about if it feels good or it's kind of what we want. We often don't overthink it because we think, well, it's kind of what I want anyway, so I'll just not ask too many questions about it or ask maybe, is this really something that is going to be good for me, or is it it's something that's drawing me away from God? Godly pleasure fulfills not just in the moment, but long after it as well. And it satisfies us while earthly pleasure leaves us feeling empty. In the end, that's what all it will do. Another aspect of it is that godly pleasure does not promote the other sinful attributes here of 2 Timothy 3, all those other ones that we read there. It's interesting that it starts out with, it says, they shall be lovers of their own self and lovers of money. The King James says covetous, but most other translations translate that lovers of money, directly referring to maybe the root of covetousness. And God's pleasure is often shared rather than spent on ourselves. And it doesn't require large amounts of money to have experienced God's pleasure and to share it with other people as well. If a Christian has been blessed with a lot of wealth, does that mean that they get a special exemption to spend a lot more money in pursuing pleasure than other Christians with less money? And that's maybe one of the questions as we look at society and ourselves as well. Is that something that is the case? Is the only moderation to our level of luxury and pleasure our income? Is it just a scale that the more money we make, then we're entitled to more and more luxury and pleasure because we have the means to afford it? Sometimes that's what it looks like, but I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that's not how it's supposed to be. And even if we are really intentional about not letting earthly pleasures take control, the more money we have, the harder and harder that's going to be. And I think that's something that we have to realize, that the more money we have, the more we will be tempted to allow ourselves a few extra notches of pleasure, a few extra notches of luxury, because suddenly it doesn't really seem like that big of a deal anymore. As our means increase. And that's one of the problems with riches, is it tempts us to keep spending a little bit more and a little bit more on ourselves and chasing pleasure. And slowly but surely we become more and more into this definition here of a lover of pleasure more than a lover of God. Another aspect is that godly pleasures reflect God's goodness. And in verse 3 there, it says that they were despisers of those that are good, and then it also talks there about, I forget how it says it exactly in the King James here, but a lot of the other translations, again, would translate this as they were not lovers of the good. In other words, they did not love good. And not loving the good is not just saying they didn't love God. It's not just another way of saying that. It does say that, that they didn't love God. But it's more talking maybe more specifically about how they loved the pleasure derived from good things, but it was untethered from God. And so they loved pleasure for the sake of pleasure, and therefore they were not loving the good, which is God, who's the source of all good. And so God created everything, and he called it very good. That's what God said about his creation. And he created it for our benefit and so that we could enjoy it. I had to think of the example of parents giving their child a gift. We want to see the child enjoy that gift. And even though it doesn't really have any benefit for us, there's a joy that the child gets in getting the gift, and we get in giving it to the child as well. Like a parent giving their children gifts, that God gave us many, many, many things that are given to us because he wants us to enjoy them. But true pleasure is only realized when the good points back to God, and that's what makes all the difference, is where the pleasure is rooted in. It's often the simple things that provide pleasure. There's the children's prayer song that we sometimes would sing, and still do every now and then, but not as much as our children get older. But thank you for the world so sweet. Thank you for the food we eat. Thank you for the birds that sing tra-la-la. Thank you, God, for everything. I think there's three things there. It talks about the world so sweet, the food we eat, the birds that sing. All of those are simple things, but yet they can be enjoyed, and they provide pleasure to us. Food, it doesn't only provide energy for our physical bodies, but it also provides pleasure as well. We can enjoy a good meal, and even the aspect of making it, if you enjoy making food. So it meets our needs, it has that purpose, but yet God also made it so that it can be enjoyed and can give us pleasure as well in a good way. And again, that can be taken to extremes too, where it becomes like, what's it Paul that said about whose God is their belly? It can turn into gluttony and things like that, but enjoyed in moderation and with thoughtfulness, it's something that God wants us to enjoy. Music is another aspect. It's worshipful to God, and it can also be pleasurable to play or to listen to as well. And so it has the aspect of being providing worship and also providing pleasure for those performing it and those listening to it. Nature points to God's creation, to the awesomeness of God, to the design of nature. And God's pleasure is just, in many ways, it's not about quantity, but it's about quality. You know, about being able to really think and focus on all the good things that we have around us, and actually take the time to think about it instead of just rushing from day to day. Being gratefully aware of how much pleasure God gives us every day that we can just simply ignore because we're too busy or we just forget to see it. All the things around us, whether it's nature or just the simple things, even the mundane things of life, when life is just kind of going along normally, we just take that for granted, and we sometimes get bored and we think we want more things to do, but then sometimes things come into our lives that upset it. A loved one dies, or we get a diagnosis or something like that, and all of a sudden all those normal days seem like such a luxury and a blessing, that when they're put in the right perspective. Maybe another area I thought of is vacations, where this can also be seen in, you know, people will spend thousands and thousands of dollars to go on luxury vacations to some exotic place and be pampered and entertained for a short amount of time because they want to get away. They want to get away from their mundane everyday life, and so they go do this, and they get home and they find that all the things that they were getting away from are still there, namely themselves most of all. And that's, you know, as Christians, do we really need to get away from ourselves and our situation, or can we just enjoy all the good things that we have? I think there's a time for vacation. Jesus went on retreats as well and spent time alone, but they probably don't need to be built around luxury and entertainment, things like that, as much around relationships and resting, which is often what we need. And just looking to reconnect with God's goodness and not for our own pleasure. Well, there's lots more that could be said about this subject, but I think I'll bring it to a close at this time. It's just, I think when you look at this first verse here, it says that in the last times, perilous times shall come. We are certainly living in those times. But we can be confident in the truth that godly pleasure fulfills, again, not just in the moment, but long after it's done. It satisfies us while earthly pleasure leaves us empty. In John 2:17, I came across these verses a month or two ago when I had my devotions, and it said, "And his disciples remembered what it was written, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up." And I thought, well, that's an interesting way to describe what they were trying to say there. But the disciples looked at Jesus and they said, "The zeal of thine house hath eaten me up." In other words, it seemed like Jesus was consumed by this mission that he was on from God, and it was what was everything about him was built around this zeal to protect the house of God. I guess that's a challenge I'd like to leave with each of us as we close this evening, is what will people remember about us when we are gone? Will it be our zeal as lovers of God, or will it be our zeal as lovers of pleasure? This time, why don't we bow our heads for a word of prayer? Dear God, I pray that you would be with us as we think about your words this evening. We pray that you would help us as we live in a place, in a culture where there's much emphasis on pleasure and being lovers of pleasure, that it would not be something that traps us into that, and that we become lovers of pleasure more than lovers of you. We just pray that you would help us to be people that are mindful of the many blessings that you do give to us, of the simple pleasures of life, and that all of that is connected to you if we just take the time to look at it and to appreciate it and be grateful for it. We just pray that you would help us as we, again, seek to work these things out in each of our lives, that your Spirit would direct us. And we ask these things in your name. Amen.